Okay, this is talking with Groat Reber on 12th March 78 at his home in Bothwell, Tasmania. And we've had a delightful weekend moving boxes around. But this is to fill in odd questions from the previous transcript and things which have come up this weekend. First of all, I was wondering why you put a solid surface on the reflector at Wheaton rather than just a mesh, which would be much lighter, of course.
Well, a mesh is only worthwhile if it stays a mesh. But if it fills up, then it's the same as a solid surface, and it can easily fill up with snow and ice in a winter climate. And if you remember, I started off at a very short wavelength, so it would have to be a very small mesh.
That's right.
So that's all there is to it.
So it was basically the high frequency that you started off at. Yeah. If you were thinking of 160 from the beginning, you probably would have...
Might have done something different.
Yeah. Also, where did you get the idea to put the preamplifier right up at the focus, which was not the usual practice until the mid-50s again, really?
Well, it just seemed obvious. That is, the signals are going to be encountered are very small, so you want the least amount of loss between the antenna and the first tube. So you put it as close to the antenna as possible. And at that stage of the game, it wasn't going to be necessary to tune it, so it could be a fixed-tune system.
Yeah. Okay. Another thing is that we've discovered many papers that letters that you sent to, for instance, Otto Struve and Shapley and to the Office of Naval Research after World War II, seeking funding with a definite two-year program. And this is when you decided you wanted to leave Wheaton for various reasons. Did you have any advice on where you should go for the money, or were you just sort of shooting around the...
Well, not really, because I had worked at industrial places up to that point, and we just serviced commercial customers, and during the war we, of course, provided equipment for the military. So I didn't have any particular idea of where I could secure any money, and these just seemed like possibilities.
And what sort of replies did you get?
Well, usually I didn't get any reply. So I deduced that people weren't particularly interested and that this was not a proper time.
And so, in fact, that was what led you to NBS, not particularly because you wanted to go.
The NBS was having its radio division reorganized, and under this reorganization there was an expansion of staff and they had some extra money. And so the management seemed to feel that they wanted to indulge in some esoteric things. But not too esoteric.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was commissioned to provide a service on making observations on solar radio waves.
And in fact, as you told me this weekend, but I hadn't realized it, you worked for NBS for 3 years till 50.
Nearly 4 years, about 3.5 years.
Till 51.
Yes.
And that's the last time you were on a salary.
That's right.
Can you just tell me how you've been supporting?
Well, I didn't work for those radio companies for free, and consequently I always had a little more money than I expended, and so that was invested in a conservative manner, and it has served me well in later years.
So you bought it during the Depression, basically.
Yes. Benjamin Franklin had something to say about that I believe that his statement was that if you were effective, you should be able to earn a living and provide yourself with enough wherewithal in the first 40 years so that you could spend the last 40 years of your life doing public interest things. And Andrew Carnegie had a similar statement from a very much richer man who stated that he should spend the first half of his life making his money and the second half of his life giving it away. I don't give much away.
Right. So in fact, all of the grants that you've had from Research Corporation have been simply for buying equipment and travel and things like this.
That's correct.
Now, in the previous interview, I got the background on your father and where he came from. I didn't get your maternal background. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, I didn't know too much about it, but there were a couple of Grote brothers came from Germany about in the 1850s. I believe they were people who were disenchanted with the German operation after the Revolution of 1848, which failed. And they were merchants, at least my grandfather was a merchant.
Mm-hmm.
And they set up there in Wheaton, Illinois, as the Grote brothers.
I see. What kind of merchandise?
Just general store.
Mm-hmm.
And I should say, this is an interesting story the old boy used to tell, that in that day there were no automobiles and horse-drawn was very poor, and so their merchandise came back and forth on the railway. And they got most of their stable products and so on from the big city, Chicago, which was 25 miles away. And it was flashed out on the telegraph that there was a big fire starting in Chicago. So my grandfather thought, boy, I better get in there and get stocked up on supplies before I get caught short. So he rushed in there on the very first early morning train that he could get, which in that day left about 4:30 in the morning. And he got into the Northwestern Station, and he was met by the police, who commandeered every able-bodied man, and everybody else was turned back to where they came from on the next train. And so he was in sort of imprisoned, well, isn't quite the right word, but anyhow, they made him pump water. Now, in that day, they didn't have any portable pumps driven by machinery, and these pumps were like on a four-wheel wagon, and there was two bars, one along each side, and they'd line about six men up on each side, and they'd work this bar up and down by hand.
Right.
And so he had a pump all day until he was completely exhausted, and then they escorted him back to the railway station and put him on a train. And he figured that there was no more point to going into the city.
Okay. What was the actual name of your father? I didn't get that also.
Schuyler Colfax Reber.
Right, and that was what your brother was named, Junior.
That's right.
And we've discovered some interesting correspondence with your brother, who was a graduate student at
Harvard
Business School. Mm-hmm. But you had him running over to Harvard Astronomy Department and the MIT Physics Department. Tell us, what did you have
him? I was trying to prompt my brother, who had, well, sensibly no interest in scientific matters and was all thumbs, in trying to represent me before people in astronomy and engineering, and this was not a very satisfactory approach.
One thing that I didn't ask about before, I'd like to now, is can you tell me what a typical day was, or a week was like, from the period 1937 to 44, in terms of just how did you spend your time?
Well, I worked in the city, of course, during the day, and usually had to leave about 7 to 7:30 in the morning, something on that order, because work in those days started at 8 o'clock and not at 9 o'clock. And then we finished at 5, and I would get back home around 6 or so, and I'd get something to eat, and then maybe look at the newspaper or listen to the radio for a little while. And then
you were living by yourself this whole time?
No. My mother was a widow. I lived there at 212 West Seminary with her. And then I would undertake to do various things on this radio astronomy business.
Right.
In the basement, usually, see? And eventually, well, I took some time out. I used to change jobs occasionally from here to there and maybe take 3 months between. There didn't seem to be any difficulty getting jobs. They were fairly plentiful. The radio was one of the big industries in Chicago. Mm-hmm. There were many manufacturers. So
even though it was a depression.
Didn't seem to.
Well, then
I think even today this is supposed to be a depression. I would try to get anybody good to do anything. They all got more work than they can handle.
Right.
It was the same thing there.
Right, but you were a good engineer though too.
Well, apparently,
So
then on weekends I would also work on these matters.
But how long did you work into the evening?
Well, it depended. When I was first making those first observations, I used to get up about midnight or 1 o'clock, maybe go to bed immediately after dinner, and then take these readings until sunrise, which time I can have some breakfast and go back to work. But it was pretty obvious this couldn't be kept up. So when I finally got some results, then I reorganized the thing so it would record automatically. And then in the evening, all I had to do was set the dish to a new declination, calibrate the equipment, let it warm up, and start the recorder operating, and then the next morning turn it off.
Right.
And that's all there was to it. So that way I got a lot more sleep.
And on weekends? You?
Well, more or less the same kind of thing, but maybe on the weekends I would work on hardware. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I would go into the city on weekends and work in the radio company shops on hardware.
Mm-hmm.
It depended, but weekends were usually hardware.
Do I have it correct that you basically, for a period of 8 years or something, really did nothing else but this and work? That you didn't take any vacations and you didn't play sports or anything like this?
Like the postman that went for a walk on his day off.
Right.
I didn't do athletics or go to various kinds of artificial entertainments and those kind of things, you know, because I just didn't have time.
Yeah. But you did tell me that you played quite a bit of tennis as a boy.
That was several years earlier.
As a teenager.
Early 20s, I used to play tennis and basketball.
Mm-hmm.
Not greatly, and I was never a great athlete or anything like that, see, because I was too light. And actually, when you get brass tacks, most of this athletic stuff seemed to be sort of dull.
Also, could you tell me some more details about your ham activities, when they began and when they stopped, and you know, more or less what you did then?
I was still in high school, and I think I got my first license in 1927 or 1928, and if we hunted in the right box, we would have found them, because they're around here. I think they're stored with my amateur radio receiver,
mm-hmm.
and a few other, and oh yeah, he's in one of those lists that gives a box that has all the QSL cards and correspondence and that
right.
kind of stuff, pictures,
right.
amateur radio. Well, anyhow, I was still in high school, and I was either 16 or 17 when I got first radio license. And then I did amateur radio for about the 4 years when I got through doing college work. Then, I graduated from college in the spring of 1933, and we saw that diploma. And then I got assorted jobs hither and yon around the Chicago area. And it was about that time that I became conversant with Chansky's work. Also, we moved about that time because my father died in 1933, and we moved the following year, I think. And I never did any more amateur radio after that at the new location where I lived, 212 West Seminary.
So you really switched from active to passive.
That's right. That's right. Electromagnetic waves right. to passive.
You did find, though, I mean, you did win a prize during that time, which we came across. What was that?
There was a Macmillan Arctic expedition. And one of the people in Chicago who had a son, I think, who was radio operator on his Macmillan expedition, put up a prize for contacting this expedition and handling messages, that kind of thing. And they didn't go very far. They were up on the coast of Labrador somewhere. I don't know how far they got, to tell the truth. Anyhow, I think there were three prizes put up, and I got one of them.
Mm-hmm.
That was during the days when I was still amateur radioing.
Do you see this period as vital or helpful in any way in terms of learning the basics of radio, or did you mainly do that through your college work?
Well, yes. It gave me some idea of how radio circuits worked and gave me expertise in the handling of tools and soldering and drilling and laying out and all that stuff. So that when I went to work in the radio industry, I had a considerable background of just simple knowledge. And while I had a degree in electrical engineering, the first job I got was just as a solder slinger in the service department, where you start at the bottom. Mm-hmm. But the engineering department, of course, was looking for people who had more than just solder slinging experience. So then I got transferred from service department to engineering.
Okay, moving on here. You mentioned in the previous transcript that you were going to try to get some of these old photos with your mother's heavy hand deblurred. Did you ever succeed in that?
Well, most of the time she was the only other person around there. So if I wanted a picture taken of me in something,
right,
she was the available person. And she had some way of coming down very fast with her thumb onto the button,
right,
which whacked the camera, and that made a blurred picture. So if you look at a blurred picture, you can practically always tell she did it.
Right, but you were going to try to get these de-blurred, though.
Ah, yes, I forgot about that.
Did that ever work out?
When did I tell you that?
Well, 2 years ago.
Well, okay, I showed them to you, did I? Well, I had them with me, and I went out to Greenbank. And I left them with those fellows there. David Hogg had them. And he made some inquiries. And apparently it can be done. But it's not done on a commercial basis. And the people he contacted were somewhat eccentric. And consequently, as far as I can able to determine, nothing has been done. But he informed me a while ago he still had the negatives. So when the time comes that this becomes a practical proposition, we'll get them to be blurred.
Okay.
A few more years ain't gonna make any difference.
Another thing that I've come to appreciate as I look at the records this weekend is the tremendous problem of feeding the antenna. There are many problems, of course, the mechanical one of the antenna, feeding the antenna, the front end, the back end, the astronomical interpretation, but it seems to me that really was quite fundamental because there was very little information about how to go about doing this.
Well, that's true. That is, in engineering school, they don't teach you astronomy, even as a liberal arts subject, because they got so many more other things they think are important for an
right.
engineer. So, I was always more or less interested in astronomy in a peripheral sort of way, and I took a few pictures of the night sky.
Right, which we found, yeah.
Yeah.
But well, you told me about this, though, but I was curious about the, in terms of feeding the antenna, the design of the feed.
How
did you proceed with that?
It's just straightforward. That is, it's pretty obvious the antenna should be arranged so it looks only at the dish. Because if it looks over the edges of the dish, then it can get extraneous radiations in from the sides.
Yeah.
Or from the back and so on. So it had to have something which would shield the antenna and only allow it to look in the desired direction toward the dish. And I think I read some articles by Southworth about this time, it was just about those same years, middle 30s, on waveguides. And I decided maybe the open end of a waveguide would mm-hmm. be a good thing. So I set up microwaves investigation and determined the shape of the aperture that would be desirable to produce any given illumination onto the dish. And then
Were these rectangular or are these the conical?
Well, they were cylindrical first, the cylinders, and there was a plunger in back so you could shorten or lengthen the cylinder behind the antenna. And if you got the antenna just exactly right, then the wave reflected from the back wall reinforced the wave, so it was sort of like a resonant chamber, mm-hmm. and the antenna was at an auspicious place. And there was a hole only in the opposite end of the chamber, so the antenna could hardly at all look outside. It was so far back up in the chamber, and the pattern is determined by the orifice. Seemed to be fairly straightforward, but maybe not too obvious. But Anyhow, I thought it was the way to go do about it.
It's to get high efficiency, though. It's not, you know, to do it at to some extent is one thing, but to do it well is something else. Now, going back even before your time, do you have any opinion on why there were no known efforts to detect the sun after the 1902 is the last effort that we know? Do you?
Well, probably the reason is that that Planck's black body radiation laws became well known, and it would be possible to compute the amount of flux arriving at the surface of the Earth from the sun at any given radio wavelength, and it was far below what any radio receiver of the day could possibly detect.
Taking 6,000 kelvins.
That's right. Right. So a 6,000 degree disk, a half a degree in diameter, would produce a 20 meters or whatever it was, such a feeble intensity that nobody even bothered. As a matter of fact, that's the reason I didn't bother to begin with.
That's right.
And then I just took a gamble, and lo and behold, it wasn't 6,000 degrees, it was more like a million.
Yeah. Okay, also before your active work, could you tell me about the story that you've heard about a fellow working in the Philippines who claimed afterwards anyway?
Well, these stories improve with age, and they change with circumstances.
Well, I'll try to track it down more if you can give me the start point.
Okay, the story is simply this. There was a young man named Gordon Stagner, S-T-A-G-N-E-R, who was one of the radio operators of RCA Communications at Manila. And this was in the early days of shortwave radio, the late 20s, or about 1930. And they were putting through a straight circuit from Bolinas, California to Manila. I've forgotten the name of the exact place near Manila. Anyhow, they used some short wavelengths, around 15 meters or 20 meters on that order. And the circuits were pretty primitive. They didn't have super heterodynes either, because I saw some of that early equipment. It was nothing but a TRF set, a regenerative detector, and an audio amplifier and some relays and things. And it came over as tone. And he found that at certain hours of the morning, early morning, the circuits seemed to have an abnormal amount of background hiss on them. At least that's his story, that they did. And that this was not present during the day, even at much higher frequencies. Now you have to remember, these circuits operated at a frequency such that the radio transmission went around the curvature of the Earth. The ionosphere was effective. That would be near the horizon, but the ionosphere might be transparent overhead. Mm-hmm. I don't think he realized that. That wasn't realized until very much later. Anyhow, he told me that he investigated this matter to the extent he could, made some observations, but best of my knowledge, he never wrote anything down. At least if he had, it's disappeared long ago.
When did he tell you this?
Well, he told me this after the war, maybe about 1953.
And when did he notice the effect?
Well, the observations were made somewhere between 1928 and 1930. I think, is of Spanish origin and a native of the Philippines.
I see.
And in the service of RCA. And I believe he had training here in America. And he's not a Filipino. And he got caught there in the war and served in the prison camp all during the war. And then when the war was over, RCA transferred him to Hawaii, and that's where I met him.
I see.
And that, she told me that after the war, the policy was to Filipinize the thing. That is, everybody on the staff had to be trained and organized and be a Filipino. See,
right.
Now Philippines is a separate government. And part of his job was to Filipinize the RCA operation in Manila. And when that was completed, then he transferred to Honolulu.
You have any idea where he is now?
In Honolulu.
You think so? Okay.
He's retired. He lives there.
Could you please tell me the story about the... you were getting so many visitors coming knocking at your front door and asking what was this strange thing that you had a solution.
Well, this contrivance, of course, created some local curiosity immediately after it was put up. But it soon became one of the features of town, like the courthouse or the church or the school or the police station there. And the local people paid no more attention to it. This happened pretty rapidly, within a couple of months, really. But occasionally there would be people come along in an automobile and they would stop and they'd gawk out of the window at this thing. And you'd immediately say, "Ah, oh, there's a stranger in town." And this was in a place which at that time was rather conspicuous. That is, it could be seen from three streets.
Uh-huh.
So, and it was not too far from, it was about 2.5 blocks from the railway station, the center of things, and could be seen from three streets. So, any stranger in town practically couldn't help but see it.
Had a high cross section to strangers.
That's right. So, occasionally they'd get out and wander around, look at it, and maybe take some pictures. And some of them would be sufficiently curious and energetic to come and push the doorbell and inquire as to what this thing was. So, we thought that it might be desirable if we got a jukebox and had a tape recording. It wouldn't be a tape in that day, but anyhow, a recording made with a sign saying, "Put quarter in slot and find out what this is all about." However, we didn't get that far.
Listen to the cosmic hiss or something
right.
Like that?
That's right. Messages from space.
What did your mother think of all this?
Well, she put up with me.
So it was just tolerated, huh?
That's true.
I one person that went down and visited you, I forget who, remembered your mother complaining about there was no room to hang up the laundry in the backyard because of this thing.
That's probably true. Probably true.
Let's see. You also told me that Fred Whipple had the idea to put an antenna, a Yagi or something, on the dome of an optical telescope. Could you talk about that?
This was many years later, after the war.
After the war, okay.
And I don't remember the circumstances, but it was probably one of these AAS meetings. And I talked to Fred. And in the 30s, he was a graduate student at Harvard. And he told me at that time, at least they had a thought about it, presumably he and somebody else, and this somebody else wasn't specified, but maybe it was Jesse Greenstein. Anyhow, as far as I know, nothing was done or even a formal proposition made to the management, but at least Fred considered it, and the idea was to put some vertical, light vertical bats on some kind of outriggers connected to the dome of the 60-inch telescope and use that mount a rhombic antenna on these outriggers and then turn around the horizon using the dome. Okay. But nothing ever came of it.
Yeah.
There's been several circumstances the same kind of thing. In other words, they're going to copy what Jansky did.
Right. Another point you made. So in the Friis article in 1965, Science, he says here that Jansky...
He wrote, for example, a detailed report on a conference that he attended on this subject at the Naval Research Laboratory in May 48. That's actually in the National Bureau of Standards. I was there.
Right. And who organized this meeting? Do you remember?
Who organized it? I think it was an IRSI thing, but I'm not too sure. It wasn't an astronomer's. It was some communications, IRSI.
Okay. But you remember Jansky giving the talk?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
You get out a menu on this conference, you'll find him. He's on there, and it'll also say National Bureau of Standards.
Right.
It's very unlikely that there are any conferences of any kind such as this at the Naval Research Laboratory. It's just
because of
prohibitively
security.
Difficult to get the personnel in.
That's true. Would you please tell me the story about the people from NBS when you were looking for a job, coming to visit? And what happened when you went to show them the sun?
Well,
and who are they?
It was sort of an extemporaneous visit, and it's written down in some of those books if we fished long enough. an appointment had been made by two fellows at NBS, Kenneth Norton and Jack Herbstreit. They'd been somewhere out in Iowa doing something, I don't know. It was 1946, and I had my 480 megacycle rig going good by that time. And an appointment was made for them to come and see what I was doing. So they did. And they got there about, maybe 11 o'clock. And so I explained the equipment to them and showed them what went on. And I suggested they hang around a little longer and see the sun transit. So they did. And the background was pretty noisy. That is, there was a lot of fluctuations on the background long before the sun got into view. It was a little bit of a normal day because you could hear all the real ignition noise in there, which wasn't near as bad at 480 as it used to be at 160. But the background was fluctuating, didn't think too much about it. And then there was a rise, which went up maybe about a third scale. And then it went back down again. And this rise was all jagged, it wasn't smooth at all. And then maybe about another 10 minutes later, there was another rise. And this rise went just practically up to the top of the scale. And then came back down again. And then pretty soon, within a few minutes, the pen went right off scale and stayed off scale for about 15 minutes at the time the sun transited. And then came back down again and went through two more side lobes.
And as you know now, but...
We knew there were side lobes then.
Oh.
See, it wasn't at all obvious until the whole apparition was over, but it was very clear once you'd seen this thing, which happened within an hour, that the sun was exceedingly strong, fluctuating, and these side lobes were now visible because the sun was up by a factor of 100 or something compared to what it normally was. Because under normal circumstances, you couldn't see the side lobes at all.
And this is the first time you've seen this sort of activity?
Well, that was probably the first time we'd seen it at 480 megacycles, yes. Mm-hmm. So they were quite impressed. And so the sun put on a good show on an important day. And during this period, when the pen was off scale, I went outside. See, the pen stayed off scale for about 15 minutes or so. So it was possible to go outside and unclamp the dish and turn away from the sun. And the pen came right back down to the ground level, background level. So then we put it back on the sun again, and the pen went right off scale again. So it was very evident these disturbances were coming from the sun. And there was some limiting on the receiver, so when the pen was put considerably off scale, you just didn't hear anything. The whole system blocked audibly. But when pen was on scale, then you could hear this fluctuating hissing noise.
Mm-hmm.
There was another fellow with him, Salisbury, from Collins Radio at Cedar Rapids. There was three of them.
Mm-hmm.
And Salisbury listened, and he thought he could hear other sounds, that is, grinding noises and that kind of thing. But none of the rest of us could.
And it wasn't long thereafter that you went to work for NBS.
That's right.
Yeah.
The next year, that is, we went through a lot of rigmarole, and finally I made arrangements to join NBS in the following year, 1947.
Well, speaking of NBS, this was the period also where you came up with the idea for